Local Currents on Public Radio, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Today we address South Florida issues with Watchdog Report publisher Dan Ricker.
Always a pleasure, John.
The report is published weekly via email and online. Good to see you again, Dan.
Thank you, Joe.
And we'll start with the rather curious situation with the Miami-Dade Property Appraiser's Office. We're joined now by County Property Appraiser Carlos Lopez Cantera. Welcome to you, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Mr. Cooper, Ms. Berman, and Mr. Ricker.
Give us a quick review, a thumbnail of the situation, which, oddly enough, may wind up in court.
Yeah, basically what's happened is in 2008, the voters of Miami-Dade County voted at 76.8% to create an elected property appraiser. And when I took office this year and started administering the office, I started to realize that I don't think that they got what they were asking for, because by means of the opinion of the county attorney's office, this office, or the person who sits in this office, is merely an elected department head, but not a constitutional officer like other elected property appraisers as close as Broward County. And the difference between an elected department head and a constitutional officer is that an elected department head is still subject to every rule, regulation, ordinance, and everything else that any other department is, and has no independence except whatever the county commission deems is fit or necessary. And, you know, whatever they give today, they can take away tomorrow, and that is just an unhealthy way to have an office, run an office, and it creates sometimes, I believe, a conflict of interest, and it's an awkward situation altogether.
So you can't use the county funds to sue the county, so are you permitted to raise private funds to finance a lawsuit against Miami-Dade County?
I'm still trying to figure that out. I have an attorney looking into it, and I'm also exploring the possibility of going before the commission with a resolution to have them allow for me, so to speak, to use funds that are already budgeted by this office and approved by the Department of Revenue for the Property Appraiser's Office to seek this clarification from the courts. And it's an awkward situation, because the county attorney says you cannot hire an attorney because I'm your attorney, yet if I end up in court, he'll be on the opposing counsel. It's very, very right. Awkward, and I believe it's a conflict, the system, the structure that is underway here with respect to the county attorney's office and the departments.
Would it be possible that if you pursue this lawsuit that you could be fired?
No. I'm elected by the residents of Miami-Dade County. They always have the option to recall me, which...
So that would be during an election then?
Yeah, it would just be during election. As far as the person who's elected, there's no direct power over that person, but every other employee of this office is considered an employee of the mayor, who's the manager, not of this office.
Dan Ricker, you cover county politics very closely. What's your take on this?
Well, I watched this whole thing. I mean, I watched the county commission put it on the ballot. I watched them create the language. I watched them create the follow-up language, the actual making the office a charter department versus a constitutional department. And I'd written about it multiple times back then that, in fact, in my opinion, I thought I was voting when I went to the polls, and I'm fairly informed, for a constitutional office like the other 65 or 64 other counties in the state of Florida. And the way the language was written, there was no asterisk saying, oh, this will be like tucked in because we're a home rule charter as just an elected county department head.
If there are any county commissioners listening now, feel free to call in, or the mayor, or county
attorneys. Meeting right there. I just came from there. I was there 35 minutes ago. They're still meeting, and hopefully going to take up the Jackson GOB bond issue.
Now, the theory behind having the independent property appraiser and be an elected official, the theory is that then the appraiser works more for the constituents, the property owners, rather than trying to ring the cash register more for the county. Is that correct, Mr. Cantera?
I believe that's what the voters thought, remember, this was in January of 2008. This was just coming off of the real estate boom where values had skyrocketed, property taxes had gotten out of control. I was in the legislature at the time and had sponsored several pieces of legislation dealing with property taxes and the value adjustment board process. And I believe that the voters wanted somebody that was accountable to them and that there would be no funny business taking place behind the scenes where, you know, there'd be a wink and a nod and, you know, you adjust the values here so we don't have to raise the millage here, or we can lower it here and raise values here to end up at a certain revenue amount. What it's starting to look like to me is that, you know, the commissioner who drafted this elected property appraiser may have been misleading the voters as far as what they thought they were getting.
And what would have been the purpose of doing that?
To maintain control over the person. To let the voters think that they have somebody that they elect and is accountable to them, but is still also accountable in many ways to the county.
Yeah, the county infrastructure.
The county infrastructure.
So changing the subject, today's Herald reported that the tax roll is up sharply, 3.39% for 2013. What does that mean for the county and for homeowners? And does that mean that the tax rate will go down now?
Well, with all due respect to the Miami Herald, I wouldn't consider 3.39% sharp, but there was an increase over last year. And whether or not this translates into a property tax increase depends on the millage rates that is set by the individual city commissions and the county commission and the school board. In areas that saw an increase in value, you would hope that they would lower their millage rate to correspond with the same percentage increase so that they're not extracting more dollars out of their property owners, because I believe that this economy is still fragile. It's not a true, healthy and robust recovery. There are signs that the real estate market is seeing activity, but it's a lot of cash coming in from South America, and you know, some of the transactions that are taking place may not be 100% arm's length transactions. They may be for other purposes other than investment or use. Maybe a place that people are just trying to park their cash and get it out of their home countries because of political situations there. Of course, that's not everything. That doesn't apply to every transaction, but by no means do I believe that the economy has fully recovered. And I would expect and I would hope as a taxpayer that the elected leaders who set millage rates would recognize that when setting their millage rates for the coming budget year.
What's going on in more, say, marginal communities, say, Homestead, Miami Gardens, and that? What are the property values doing there?
Homestead saw a marginal increase of 0.12%, so that's a 0.12%. Opa-locka saw a reduction in their taxable value of 5.46%. Hialeah, a reduction of 3.5%. Miami Gardens, a reduction of 1.92%. Palmetto Bay, a reduction of 0.62%. Other areas that have increases, Sunny Isles Beach, 10.32% increase in their taxable value. Indian Creek, an increase of 19.53% in their taxable value. City of Miami, a 4.47% increase. Coral Gables, a 2.12% increase. So the higher value areas and saw increases, and areas that haven't caught up in the market either remained relatively flat or saw decreases. A lot of the movement was based on commercial properties and condominiums. Condominiums actually came back. Their values started to increase dramatically in 2012, and they were a big driver in a lot of the areas, especially areas that have large numbers of condominiums.
So it's the haves and the have-nots.
Well, I don't think it's haves and have-nots. I think it's more, you know, where the market chose to, you know,
respond
to invest its money, where it wanted to invest.
So Homestead has really bounced back, because at one point they were in the negative 20s as far as their property values. So now they're in the black?
Yeah, marginally.
Right.
They're marginally in the black. But the what was a saving grace for Homestead was the new construction. There was $30 million of new construction put on their tax roll that I think took them over. If not, they would have been in the black. Right. I'm sorry, in the red, but for that new construction that was added to their tax roll.
Okay.
They'd probably be in the red.
Why, if one's market value goes down, can one's property value go up on the trim notice?
Because of something called the clawback in the Save Our Homes. It was an unintended consequence of the Save Our Homes Amendment. And this past November, there was an amendment on the ballot, Amendment Number 4, that would have had a fix in there, or the ability for the legislature to fix it statutorily, but that amendment failed at the ballot box. So that's still an issue that needs to be addressed, but it can only be addressed by the Constitution. And during my time in the legislature, we tried to find a way to do it statutorily, but it became very clear that it had to be done via the Constitution. And I believe that it was that amendment failed because of other reasons. I think if people really understood what it was doing, then it may have passed. But I think it fell victim to this notion out there that you need to go in and vote down all the amendments to send a message.
Well, the ballot was also such a mess,
and the language was so arcane.
Well, when you're dealing with property tax and Save Our Homes and the Constitution, it has to be a certain way to achieve the intended result. It's very hard to put in a very short summary everything that amendment was going to do. So the sponsor of the amendment chose to put the entire language of the amendment so that there was no misunderstanding and there was no risk of the Supreme Court kicking it off the ballot because of a misleading summary.
Right. A vagueness.
A vagueness. And it had been attempted before, and one of the unions sued and got it kicked off the ballot a previous year. So in an attempt to avoid the same fate, there is no miscommunication. There is no vagueness if you're putting the entire language of the amendment on the ballot, and that's what happened with all the amendments.
Miami-Dade property appraiser Carlos Lopez-Cantera. We're going to take a short break. Sir, would you like to stay with us and maybe take some listener calls after our break?
Happily.
We'll be back with more.
You can find Topical Currents on Facebook, a dedicated page with daily program descriptions, links to our guests, authors, and books. Facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And welcome back to Tuesday's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're visiting with Dan Ricker, journalist and publisher of the Independent Watchdog Report, as well as the Miami-Dade County property appraiser, Carlos Lopez-Cantera. If you have a question or a comment for either gentleman, you can call us at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. You can email radio@WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents.
Does anyone ever tweet us during the program, Bob?
We haven't. We have a lot of followers, but no one's ever tweeted yet.
Maybe someone could be the first.
So, Mr. Lopez-Cantera, how are assessments determined, and why can two identical homes have different tax rates?
Well, there's several factors that can affect that. Residential assessments are basically done via the comparable approach, which is looking at determined area, sales that occurred in that area, and then determining what the range of values for those types of homes, taking into consideration different details, different factors like pools and square footage. And the reason that sometimes one property owner will look at their house online and then look at their neighbors and say, well, their assessed value is lower and they're paying less in taxes. Why? Well, there's a couple reasons. But the biggest reason is the Save Our Homes amendment on the Constitution, which caps your property value for tax purposes the year you are granted the homestead to 3% increases or CPI, whichever is lower. And this year, CPI was 1.7, so that's the increase. For
what's CPI?
The Consumer Price Index.
Okay.
And I had a case where a property owner just last week came to me and said, look, my neighbor, is their assessed value is a lot lower than mine, and their house is bigger. And the reason is that the property owner took advantage of the portability opportunity and ported about $140,000 in Save Our Homes benefit from their previous house to their new house, and that kept their assessed taxable value lower. So those are the biggest reasons why homeowners see different rates as far as themselves and their neighbors.
What's the process to appeal your assessment? I understand that so many people used to do that. Now you still have to pay, even if you appeal, you have to pay a portion of the taxes first. Is that correct?
Right. The way that the process works is once you get your trim notice at the end of August, you have 25 days to either come into the office and have an informal conversation about the value or file an appeal before the Value Adjustment Board, which is independent from this office. And once you file an appeal, before it can be scheduled, you have to pay 75% of your taxes in order to be eligible for the appeal. We've actually created some new policies and opportunities here in the office. We posted values online at the beginning of June so that property owners could take a look months sooner than it had ever been done before. And we've created a new system here in the office where you can come in now and have those informal conversations with an evaluator who has the authority to make a value decision up to 15% on the spot when justified. We also have a informal assessment review form that we created where you can download the form, fill out your information, fill out your justification for why you're overassessed, send it in, and you'll get an answer back in a week or two, rather than having to file an appeal, which historically can take from 12 to 16 months to get an answer.
And what percentage of these appeals are successful?
Historically, about 50% of them are successful in Miami-Dade County. In 2009, there were 140,000 appeals. In 2010, just over 100,000. 2011, about 90,000. And 2012, around 70,000.
So the deadline for filing the appeal is still 25 days after you receive the trim notice.
Right. And you're not even eligible to file the appeal until after you receive the trim notice. But like I said, we've posted values online, and they're available now. So anybody who's listening who looks up their property, if they think today, well, my property is overassessed for taxable purposes, they can use the new policies that I just described and maybe get an adjustment, because when valuing on the mass appraisal approach on a per square mile basis, it's easy to miss details that only an individual property owner knows about their property, and we're more than willing to make adjustments when justified so that people get their answer, know their taxable value even before their trim notice goes out, and then they don't even have to worry about an appeal, and they'll know that their tax bill is fair and just.
What if you get a professional appraisal? Does that count?
That does. If you bring in a professional appraisal for your home, that definitely does make a difference and can be used to adjust the value. Absolutely.
Hey, Carlos, I'd be curious, since you were not a county employee and you came from the state, you know, as a state representative, et cetera, what are your thoughts on the culture at the county and your office when you came in? You've made your office a lot more customer friendly. I believe there's the sign that says, you know, welcome. What, you know, how can we help you?
How can we help you? Yeah.
Right. I mean, so you came into a very stratified and fixed culture. Mm-hmm. What are your observations about, the people in your office? I'm sure, you know, they're very dedicated, but do you, you know, as an outsider, did you notice anything, as far as the general culture and atmosphere and how people go about their jobs?
Yeah, I believe there was a lack of, without disparaging my predecessor, there was a bit of a lack of leadership, a lack of communication with the employees of the office. The priority of the office before was the tax roll and the sanctity of the tax roll, and that was the driving force of everything, and everything flowed from there. I came in and I said, our number one, our number two, and our number three priority are customer service. That is our priority, and that's who we work for. That's who pays our salaries, and that's who we should respond to with the as quick and efficient, as pleasurable experience as possible. And that's what I've been pushing since the day I got here. And everything that we do here is with that in mind. What is the best for the property owners and the people who are, in reality, our bosses?
Let's take a call or two. First up, we have Seth. He's in Coconut Grove. Hi there.
Hi. Your predecessor refused to accept short sales and other sales that he didn't consider arm's length as market value. Do you consider those as part of the market value now?
Yes. The answer is yes.
Explain that a little more, Mr. Quintero.
Yeah, a lot of those transactions were disqualified and not taken into consideration when considering values in neighborhoods. my philosophy is if a short sale, foreclosure affects your market value in your neighborhood, then it, of course, should affect your taxable value. And that's how we've been operating. The difference is that in 2012, foreclosures and short sales, the sale prices started to reach and at times exceed sales prices of regular arm's length transactions. So the downward or the negative pressure that would have been felt in 2008, 9, and 10 or 11 tax rolls wasn't felt as greatly in the 2013 tax roll because the numbers of the transactions that were included that weren't included before started to reach the same market prices as other transactions.
Mr. Property Appraiser, you know, with the appraisals going up now, I remember in 06 there was actually a property tax increase from $212 billion to $245 billion for the county overall. That was a 21.3% increase. And at the time I wrote, you know, obviously this cannot be sustained. This is a huge bubble, et cetera. Are you seeing or do you think that we're moving in some ways into that kind of problem again? You know, when you start to see these 10%, I mean, some of the numbers that are floating out there, I'm just not sure they can be sustained. And I feel like we're just about to go through this whole exercise again, except the only good thing is it's not through mortgages that are incredibly leveraged, but it's people, you know, either protecting their cash or perhaps money laundering or whatever, trying to get into real estate here in America, which is, quote, safe.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do believe that we're back in that cycle. The condominium market, I believe, is showing it. I had a conversation with a developer that develops condominiums in South Florida recently, and he was telling me that he's even surprised at some of the per square foot prices that his units that he's selling are demanding now. And they've already, in some of his developments, have already exceeded numbers of the boom times. And he told me kind of in a kind of a generic way that he believed that the bubble was back, and it was about a 3-year time frame as far as how long it would take. So, yeah, I believe we're back in the same cycle. I think it also has to do with the amount of demand that by far exceeds the supply as far as units, because when the market tanked, nobody was building, and so there were no units ready to hit the market when the demand just increased exponentially from 1 year to the next, from last year to this year. So it's a product of the supply versus demand. I mean, just the basics of economics.
It seems like there's such a glut of condos that were built, though, during the boom that...
Oh, no. Those have all been bought and accounted for, and those condominiums, those deals and foreclosures on condominiums are a thing of the past. Those don't exist anymore.
Sir, getting back to this quandary with the county commission and your office's independence, run it by us again of what your intentions are, that you may have to raise private money to sue Miami-Dade County over its for your office's independence. But couldn't there be a conflict of interest there if you're going out to businesses or something and raising money?
Well, I signed a contract with an attorney using funds that were already approved in the budget by the Department of Revenue and this office's budget. I had ended a contract for a larger amount and then realized the savings and then took from that line item and my intent was to pay for it from that line item. I had contracted with Dan Gelbert to represent me in the capacity as property appraiser, and then at the last minute the county attorney blocked the finance department of the county from issuing the check of the retainer. It was kind of a surprise, so it left me kind of in a limbo situation where, yes, one of the options is to go raise money from the community, but if it comes to that, I will try to avoid raising money from
people you
that
people,
may be considered
companies
may,
that you would be assessing.
Would you consider using your own money?
You know, if I had more of my own money right now, I would.
What kind of money are we talking about?
Well, you know, Dan will see my financial disclosures.
Right.
He's the king of financial disclosures. I don't have a lot of cash on hand.
Right.
I will avoid going and seeking contributions from, you know, like real estate associated type of industries developers and whatnot, because it could appear that it's a conflict, and just to avoid the appearance. But it doesn't mean that I won't seek other people who. Actually, I was surprised when the Herald wrote their editorial about this whole situation. I started getting phone calls, unsolicited phone calls from people that I know saying, hey, let me know how I can help. I want to help you, raise some money for this cause. So, and those were people that have nothing to do with real estate. I mean, they own their own home or they may own their own properties, but they're not real estate-driven business men or women.
But I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the fact that it's a charter office is so subtle that to the voters, when they went to the polls in 08, I know I did, and I'm fairly informed, thought they were voting for a constitutional office like all the other counties.
Well, if you look at the state constitution at the time, the state constitution says charter counties can eliminate constitutional offices in their charter. And if you go to the Miami-Dade County Charter, there's a paragraph that is dedicated to which offices are abolished via this right afforded in the constitution. But in 2008, the property appraiser was stricken from that list. So my belief is, well, then if it's not stricken if it's not abolished in the charter where the way the Constitution says, then it's not abolished at all. Hence, it refers to a constitutional officer. And I got an informal opinion from the Attorney General's office that said, yes, based on what we're looking at, it is reasonable to believe that the office reverted to a constitutional office.
Well, we want to thank you very much. That's the Miami-Dade County property appraiser, Carlos Lopez-Conterna. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
We are also speaking with Dan Ricker, and he's publisher of the Independent Watchdog Report on today's topical currents. We need to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is our Tuesday edition of Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, and frequent contributor Dan Ricker, publisher of the Watchdog Report. Dan, in today's newspaper, Dr. Marvin Dunn, of course, the formerly the psychology department head at FIU, and of course, he wrote the ultimate book on the 1980 Miami riots. And he was saying there's a possibility of violence and vandalism should the jury rule in favor of George Zimmerman and either exonerate him. What are your feelings about that? And should we even discuss it and put ideas in people's heads?
Well, there's that aspect, but last week Dr. Dunn was speaking at a luncheon that I covered, and he was, rhetorically asked that question, why haven't we had any riots since the 89 Overtown riot was the last one.
During the Super Bowl.
I was in Sydney, Australia, and I'll never forget it. They're panning the city, and I have all these Australian friends there, and we're seeing the flames in the background. They're, looking at me like, what kind of, where did you come from? But he also, and Dr. Dunn said that part of the reason he thought was that the demographics had changed, and part of the problem in the 80s, especially coming off the McDuffie riot, which was much more severe, where almost 20 people died, etc., that it was more the relationship between the community and the police and the Miami police at the time, how there wasn't accountability. And the state attorney's office. And there was rampant shootings or what they considered abuse within the African-American community. And he doesn't believe, while there's unresolved shootings right now in the city of Miami and Miami Beach, that because of this demographic change, the conditions and the frustration within the community aren't quite the same.
We're speaking with journalist and publisher of the Independent Watchdog Report, Dan Ricker. If you'd like to join in the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Email us at radio@WLRN.org, or you can tweet us, and that's @topicalcurrents. So, Dan, what about this? All state and county leaders' financial disclosures will be online now?
Absolutely. The Florida legislature this past spring had a moment of this is more logistics in the sense that they've always been available, but it's only been to people like myself. I must have 6, possibly 7 or 8 thousand of these. I mean, I have Governor Bush's and Charlie Crist's 1040s because that's what they filed since 98 on. I mean, it's, and I've made, to a certain extent, part of my trademark was I don't put people's age. I always put their net worth if they're an elected leader. Now, anyone in the state, anyone can go online, and I had the, it's on my webpage at watchdogreport.net. You go online, you click the Florida Ethics Commission, and there's right there, you hit the individual. There's a number of ways to look. You type in the person's name, and they're, right now they're slowly putting them all up. It okay. started July 1st, so they're not all on. But in the next 2 or 3 months, you'll see absolutely everyone's. And probably
from the, city council people.
No, not municipalities. They file with the county. But if, the, if you're a county official at any of the counties, the 67 counties, or a elected state rep, official. Senator, governor, CFO, anything like that, and all the people in the state administration or in other positions that have to file the, what is known as the Form 6 state form for disclosure, financial disclosure, they will eventually all be online so that anyone can look at them at any time. And it's quite remarkable.
Dan, tell me about Rick Scott and his prospect for re-election in 2014.
You know, Florida job unemployment is now at 7.1, the lowest it's been since like 07, 08. He's not a warm and fuzzy guy. He's actually very shy. It's taken him a while to kind of become a little more politico, where now he works a crowd. The first couple of years, he would you know, shake someone's hand or whatever, but now he really kind of comes in and works the area because he's been low. I mean, he was in the polls, he was tanking, and now he's up into the low 40s, I believe, the last set. You know, so people, while they approve of the economy getting better, they may or may not be strictly attributing it to his, you know, administration.
Any front runners on the Democratic side for governorship?
You know, you've got, obviously, you know, Governor Crist, who was a Republican, who became an independent.
Probably would be the strongest, would you say?
Well, and is now a Democrat. He could be, quote, the strongest in name recognition right now, but because of his tremendous record, Scott's planning to raise $100 million for the campaign. Governor Crist, you know, has a giant bullseye on his back, which is all the previous statements he's made over the years since he was known as Chain Gang Charlie.
When he was Commissioner of Education.
In 95. No, that was when he was a state senator and then became Commissioner in 98 of Education. But my point is, he has a huge Republican track record. It's tough. I find candidates in this, you know, I was thinking about this in 04. You know, John Kerry said to George Bush, too, during the campaign, it was essentially, I'm not him. Versus people running on ideas, people running on their own basis, philosophy, or whatever. And a candidate that's essentially saying, I'm not that the other person, it's tough for them to win, I think.
How about Hispanic voters and Scott?
Well, you know, again,
South Florida is probably different.
Right, it's different. You know, we have a more of a Republican GOP flavor. But he's, you know, he doesn't speak Spanish. The biggest thing is he's not a warm and fuzzy kind of guy. I mean, he's you know, essentially fairly shy. The question is, does he get passion out of the voters? And the other thing is, in 2014, people forget, especially the Democrats, they're very good at mobilizing for the presidential election. But when it comes to these off-year elections, you'll see a 20, 30, maybe 35% drop in voter participation around the state as far as turnout. And that hurts the Democrats more than Republicans.
Let's talk about the government obligation bond, $830.6 million requested by the Public Health Trust to be put on the November ballot.
I've been covering Jackson since 1997. And in 2000, when the commission, the county commission, began or changed, they shifted about $69, $70 million in unfunded mandates to Jackson. Jackson at the time had about $500 million in their capital reserves that they were going to use for infrastructure needs and had very carefully saved that. It's not, you don't just suddenly say, you know, over, you know.
Year is this? 2000?
That was in 2000.
Okay.
But, I mean, they had, you know, for years earlier, slowly save. And I kept telling some of the senior leadership on the Public Health Trust Board at the time that the county commissioners were eyeing this money. And I said, listen, when it comes to cash like that, government is a crack addict. And you got to start, you know, committing this money, bonding it out or somehow so that it's not touchable. And the commission during the budget hearings in 2000 shifted these unfunded mandates over to Jackson. And now here we are 13 years later, and they went through that $500 million by about 2003, because also uncompensated care was going through the roof at Jackson. But what that money did, that initial money did, was start the big cultural push. It moved about $25 million into cultural-type programs, and that was the beginning of what is now the quote, the flourishing cultural programs that we have, which are fine. I just
such
didn't,
as what?
Huh?
Well, the Arts Center, stadiums,
you know, the
museums.
I mean, all the challenge grant, all the stuff that's going on now in the arts, which has really blossomed over those years, which is fine. I love the arts. I just didn't want it, or I just questioned, should it have come at the expense of some of the infrastructure at Jackson?
Right.
And it was a political situation. And so that's why I kind of hold the county commissioners' feet to the fire on this subject, just because, you know, hey, you were part of the problem.
We're speaking with Dan Ricker. He's a journalist and publisher of the Independent Watchdog Report on today's topical currents. One more short break, and we'll be right back with you.
And we're back. It is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Dan Ricker, our number 1-800-743-WLRN. We have some lines open. Not a lot of time. 1-800-743-9576. Also email radio@WLRN.org. Tell me, Dan Ricker, the status of Miami-Dade Animal Services after voter okayed the straw ballot, but now the commission seems to be waffling a bit on that.
Well, it's not so much waffling, but they need to create the legislation that will, I mean, essentially what it is making it or increase funding. It'll be part
for no-kill animals.
Right.
Services.
It'll be part of a budget line item that the mayor has discretion on and will implement. But it's about $18 to $20 million infusion of money into a major countywide spray and neuter program, and also you know, spading for dogs as well, to try to reduce the population, because right now dogs have a higher adoption rate, except for really large dogs and apparently brown and black ones, which are somehow being discriminated against. But
so you want to be a light-colored dog,
yeah,
and
right,
small.
And small.
Yes.
And cats are just, there's just so many cats. I mean, we're talking 30-some thousand. And then unfortunately, they've had to, like, put them down. And they're trying to do this massive spay and neutering program that will utilize not only public facilities, but also private veterinarians, etc.
We did a program on this issue a while back before the vote. I forget what it was said, that it would cost the average homeowner something like
nothing,
or $10 a year or something.
Yeah,
like that.
I mean,
well,
some nominal, yeah,
well,
amount. I don't remember exactly.
You know, the extra that we were talking about with the property appraiser, the extra bump that the county gets, that's actually only $3 million by the increased value of the property. So it's such a giant beast that any funding extra is not that big of a deal.
Right.
What's going on in Broward County briefly? Any stories you're working on that are Broward related?
I'll start periodically. I did Lori Parrish's financials this past week, and I'll start through everyone else's.
And most of your stories start with a politician's name and then says net worth,
right,
you know, $125,000.
Well, they're up there. They're having some of the same issues we have down here, which is there's a number of elected leaders that may not live in their districts, and that's a problem.
I wanted to ask you, Dan, about this Project Impact after you are okay.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, this federal grant that closed down, that was taken away because for fighting youth joining gangs. What happened with that?
Started in 02. Jeez, excuse me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Maybe we should take a little short break or something. Or...
You okay?
Yeah, let me just clear my throat.
Excuse me. Sorry, I've never done that.
Okay.
I mean, not cough, but...
It's a live radio.
No, the federal program started in 02, but had no checks and balances. And, oh, geez.
Let's take a short break here, Lion, and let Dan recover on this throat.
This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. We'll be back to Topical Currents in just a moment. Let's take a quick check of weather. Still having some light rain in the Miami area. Thunderstorms, a very big possibility, 60% chance of thunderstorms this afternoon. Our current temperature is 78 degrees. Overnight, it'll be a 50% chance of showers and a low of 78.
Okay.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Dan Ricker is...
sorry about that.
Recovering.
Okay,
it was a federal grant, and it was to try to reduce kids' involvement in local gangs called Project Impact, and it was shut down. Why?
Started in 02, was run by the Miami Schools Police Department. It was taken over in 08. The administration under Superintendent Alberto Canvarlo wanted to look at it, and they started to look at it, and they found widespread abuse, poor documentation, to the point that the Department of Labor, the IG there, got involved. The state
Inspector
attorney,
General.
The Inspector General got involved. The state attorney got involved. The school police internal affairs got involved, and Currently, the grant has been rescinded, and the problem is, as the board chair, Perla Tavares-Hatman, said, there may be IRS issues because there wasn't withholding of some of this money, and as she said at the end, we don't know where this $4 million went, and that's the problem. And also, on a slightly secondary nature, the school board had been kept out of the loop, so for 3 years while this investigation was going on...
To their chagrin.
They weren't aware of it, even though, you know, when it hit the fan... they would be the ones that would ultimately would be kind of criticized for it.
So it's just been shut down?
Yes.
And what kind of abuses were they? I mean, nobody knows where the money went?
Well, it wasn't documented. You couldn't confirm that people that were supposed to be getting help were getting help. It just was really, it was the poster child, as the summation of the audit came out, of what not to do when you're dealing dealing with a federal grant and administrating one. I mean, it was scathing. And it's a shame because it's a great program. I mean, gangs, kids going into gangs is a huge problem down here.
Yeah.
So
we talked about the general obligation bond, $830 million for the public health trust. But tell us a little more. Fill us in on Daryl Sharpton, now the chair of the public health trust.
He's a CPA. He's been on the Financial Recovery Board for the last 2 years as the vice chair. Sharp guy. His son plays for the Houston, whatever the NFL team is.
Texans.
He's a UM grad. No, he's a good guy. But, I mean, he happens to be on a ship. It's not the Titanic, but it's a ship that has all kinds of problems. And he doesn't have the prerequisite miracle wand that some situations, you know, seem to call for. And they're trying to, you know, they brought it in the Jackson into the black. It made $4 million in May. They turned around a system, a healthcare system, that over a three-year period a couple years back was losing $300-400 million. So, you know, it's brought back from the brink, but now, which is why now the call for the infrastructure of upgrades is so important. Now, that's been around this has been since 08. People have been saying, oh, we need $600 million and $1 billion in infrastructure. Now it's much higher. The question is, will there be accountability, and will they get any more independence from the county commission? Because I think that's going to be necessary if this is if the voters countywide are going to pass it.
Dan, tell us a little bit more about you
and how to get
Watchdog Report history and how people can get it.
WatchdogReportNet.net is online. Just type in Watchdog Report. And it'll come up. UM built the webpage. Thank you very much.
And you've been doing this now 14 years.
So you've been
on this program for 14 years.
Yeah, it's been over 100. It's about 120 times that I've been here.
Really?
Yeah.
Gosh.
But who's counting?
Yeah. I have a general idea. But
it didn't seem like that many. I guess we've been having fun.
Yeah. Well, it's over 14 years. But it's been great. I really appreciate doing this show. But I started in May of 2000, right after Ileon Gonzalez, which had divided our community, right along racial lines and ethnic lines, and it just seemed to be that we needed someone to try to bring together some of these.
And the address for people to email to get a copy
is just Watchdog or Publisher at WatchdogReport.net.
As always, thank you,
Dan
Ricker.
All right, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.
And that's today's edition. Was produced by Richard Ives, technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Free audio archives and program downloads at our website, that's WLRN.org, and more information and additional links as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program features author and National Review columnist Kevin Williamson. He says that while consumer goods and services grow better, government projects grow more expensive and less expensive. To the calendar, on this day in 1916, 97 years ago, the birth of actor Ken Curtis in Lamar, Colorado. Best known as Gunsmoke's Festus Hagen. He wasn't a rube, he was a singer in the Tommy Dorsey Band. And on this day in 1955, 58 years ago, ABC premieres The Lawrence Welk Show, featuring a 24-piece band with the Champagne Lady, alto Elise Lahn. It lasted 27 years. Amid controversy, Lon left the show in 1959. Wonderful, wonderful. And one more, while we muse on The Wild One and The Godfather, on this day in 2004, 9 years ago, the death of acting great Marlon Brando in Los Angeles at age 80. Born in Omaha, his Broadway role as Stanley Kowalski in Streetcar began his mercurial career. And we leave with a thought from Ken Curtis as Curtis Festus said to Jefferson Dooley in a Gunsmoke episode called Hard Luck Harry. Festus said, "If this gun goes off, it'll be the first thing that ever was inside your head." Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, next to Tira Now from NPR News.